Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present a review of recent Supreme Court rulings with Dr. Steffi Wohlhandler of Physicians for a National Health Program, who considers the court's ruling on President Obama's Affordable Care Act and the way forward for advocates of a single-payer health care system. Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project, who assesses the Supreme Court decision barring mandatory life sentences without the possibility of parole for youths convicted of murder. And Bill Chandler, Executive Director of the Mississippi Immigration Rights Alliance, who provides analysis of the High Court's ruling on Arizona's controversial SB 1070 immigration law. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Every month, a select group of staff from congressional intelligence committees travel to CIA headquarters to watch classified videos of drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen. With high-level security clearances, congressional staffers have viewed images of Hellfire missiles smashing into buildings and vehicles associated with suspected terrorists. Top committee staff have access to classified material, including telephone intercepts and CIA assessment reports of each drone strike. According to the Los Angeles Times, increased oversight of the drone program is the result of requests by California Senator Dianne Feinstein, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Pakistani officials continue to complain that drone strikes are killing dozens of innocent civilians. Brigadier General Abdullah Dogar, a defense attaché at the Pakistan Embassy in Washington, D.C., points to an incident on March 17, 2011, that killed 45 civilians, including members of a tribal council. The Washington, D.C.-based New America Foundation says that at least 471 civilians were killed in U.S. drone attacks since 2004, but congressional staffers assert that the number of casualties in Pakistan is not reliable. Dissent is now beginning to surface in Congress over so-called signature strikes, in which the U.S. uses drones to attack armed men who intelligence analysts say fit a pattern of behavior that indicates they are involved in terrorist activities. While the Obama administration has curbed signature drone strikes in Pakistan, the CIA has been given the green light to carry out such attacks in Yemen, home to al-Qaeda's most active affiliate. 26 members of Congress signed a letter to President Obama in June, complaining the U.S. drone campaign has virtually no transparency, accountability, or oversight. Developing and poor nations around the world are quickly embracing universal health care to boost economic growth and fight entrenched poverty. By 2008, 50 countries had established systems of near-universal health coverage, and that number is expected to triple in the near future. According to an April Global Health Report by the Council of Foreign Relations, China, India, Indonesia, and South Africa, which account for 40% of the world's population, have launched major campaigns for universal health care. In 2009, China pumped $124 billion into its health sector. By 2011, more than 95% of all Chinese had some form of health coverage. Universal health care was pioneered in the late 19th century by German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, who introduced health care for blue-collar workers. Developing nations have looked to a number of models in crafting universal coverage, such as the British National Health Service and the German model, financed by both the state and employer-employee contributions. The United States remains one of the only industrialized nations in the world without a universal health care system. President Obama's Affordable Care Act, recently upheld as constitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court, leaves 26 million U.S. citizens without coverage. Despite the failure of the U.S. to provide leadership on universal health care, nations around the world are moving away from America's privatized for-profit system and toward a state-sponsored model that provides benefits to marginalized populations, including the poor, the elderly, and victims of catastrophic illnesses. In the days before Florida's pivotal Republican presidential primary, Mitt Romney sat down for an interview with Univision's top news anchor Jorge Ramos in Miami. It was an important opportunity for Romney to appeal to Florida's diverse Latino population who watch Univision for its popular Spanish-language news and entertainment programming. Romney wanted to soften his image among Latinos after taking a hardline anti-immigrant stance in conservative states that included his opposition to the DREAM Act, which provides a path to citizenship for young, undocumented immigrants. Political strategists say to be competitive in the November election, Romney must move to appeal to Latino voters, who will play a decisive role in the fall election in battleground states like Florida, Nevada, Colorado, and Arizona. Romney now has the lowest approval rating among Latinos since GOP candidate Bob Dole lost to Bill Clinton in 1996. This fall, an expected 12 million Latino voters will go to the polls. On a typical evening, Univision will draw 65% of all viewers watching Spanish-language television. Jorge Ramos, host of the nightly news show, is seen by many as the Walter Cronkite of Hispanic news. Ramos has interviewed the biggest Latin American newsmakers, including Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro, and says he's looking to make an impact on the U.S. presidential election. The news anchor observed, "The reality is the Hispanic community is underrepresented. We are 17% of the population, and we should at least have 17 U.S. senators, but we only have two." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In a long-awaited decision from the Supreme Court, the justices handed down a 5-4 ruling on June 28th that upheld the constitutionality of President Obama's Affordable Care Act, which mandates that all citizens who are financially able purchase private health insurance or be subject to a tax or penalty. Conservative Chief Justice John Roberts surprised many by siding with the court's liberal members, providing a majority opinion that will allow the health care reform legislation to be implemented as planned by 2014. However, in writing the court's opinion, Roberts explained that he upheld the legislation's individual mandate as a tax, not as a valid exercise of Congress's Commerce Clause power. In its decision, the court trimmed back the power of the federal government to impose the Affordable Care Act's goal of expanding Medicaid eligibility in the states. By a 7-2 vote, the justices prohibited Washington from withdrawing all Medicaid funds to states that refused to participate in the expansion. Despite the court's ruling, public opinion polls find that the nation remains largely divided on their support or opposition to the health care reform law. However, the reasons many oppose the bill vary widely. Advocates for a single-payer universal health care system, such as exists in most other industrialized nations of the world, are critical of the Affordable Care Act for its severe limitations. They point out that once fully implemented, some 26 million Americans will not be covered under the law, and that the measure won't do much to effectively contain sharply rising health care costs. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Steffi Wohlhandler, professor of public health at the City University of New York and co-founder of the group Physicians for a National Health Program. Here she assesses the Supreme Court ruling on the Affordable Care Act and the way forward for advocates of a single-payer health care system.
You know, it's a good thing that the Supreme Court decided to obey the Constitution rather than play politics. I think them playing politics and overturning the law on really bogus grounds would have been a very bad thing. The law has some modest benefits, but they are modest indeed, and there are also some very big downsides to the Obamacare law. One of the biggest downsides is that when it's fully implemented, the law will leave 26 million Americans completely uninsured. And we know from some prior work we've done that when you have 26 million Americans, you can expect to have about 26,000 deaths annually caused by lack of health insurance. So 26 million uninsured Americans is simply unacceptable to me as a physician, and it means we need to be moving forward toward that single-payer, expanded, improved Medicare for all that you were talking about earlier.
Dr. Wohlhandler, from your perspective of being an advocate of single-payer, is having the Affordable Care Act in place after the Supreme Court ruling a better place, a better starting point for universal coverage than if the law was struck down by the Supreme Court or repealed in the near future?
Well, it's hard to say. At this point, the Obamacare is the law of the land. I doubt it's going to be repealed, so I think that's the base we're starting from. So the slogan we're using is forward to single payer. Whether you think Obamacare was a slight step forward, a step backward, a step to the side, is somewhat irrelevant now because this is what we have, and it's clear that it's not a solution, that we're still going to have 26 million uninsured people, that we're still going to have tens of millions more middle-class people who buy health insurance in good faith only to find that when they get a serious illness, their insurance fails them, that there's too many gaps like copayments, deductibles, and uncovered services, so that despite having health insurance, they still can't afford care. So, and the health care costs are going to continue to go through the roof, and all of those things are going to push us to a new round of reform. I don't expect to hear much about that until 2014 when the law goes into effect and people get a chance to look at what it is and say, wow, this is in effect, it's fully implemented, and there's nothing here for my family, and there's nothing here for me, and my health care is still too affordable, and I can't get the health care I need and deserve. So we do expect the debate to reopen fairly soon after full implementation in 2014. Until then, I think a lot of folks will continue to be very confused about what's in the bill and what isn't. Some of that confusion sown by the sort of crazy talk that the Republicans have been doing, but some of the confusion actually sown by people who support President Obama and feel like they can't say a word bad about anything he's doing. I certainly hope Obama beats Romney in next election, but I don't think it's reasonable for people to keep their mouths shut and not tell the truth about the problems and some of these laws that Obama has passed.
The political reality and the estimation of many observers is that the giant insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies call the shots in Washington. And the question really is, how can their power and money be defeated and allow a single-payer or Medicare for All system to go forward? What's the focus of your work going to be in the coming months and years?
Well, we think we need to build a movement. The way we got civil rights in this country was not a bunch of politicians talking about it, but building a movement to win civil rights. The way we ended the Vietnam War in this country wasn't, you know, persuading politicians. It was a political movement. And the American people are really suffering under the current health care system. They may like the doctors and hospitals, but they're tormented by the payment system, knowing that when they get sick, they can be bankrupted, that if they somehow manage to get care, you know, they're ruining their grandkids' future by spending all the family assets. So people really suffer under the current health care system, and I think it's really not just possible but probable that we'll be able to build a movement of the American people to demand a single-payer solution. I'm very unhappy with corporate power in Washington, but we're not giving up on democracy. We still think we can make democracy work if people get involved.
That was Dr. Steffi Wohlhandler, professor of public health at the City University of New York and co-founder of the group Physicians for a National Health Program. Learn more about groups advocating a single-payer healthcare system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In another important ruling before its summer adjournment, the Supreme Court voted 5-4 that imposing mandatory life sentences without the possibility of parole on those convicted of murder when they were juveniles is unconstitutional. However, under the ruling, judges can still sentence juveniles to life without parole, but only on a case-by-case basis. The High Court had abolished the death penalty for juveniles in 2005, and in 2010 had eliminated life without parole for juveniles for crimes not involving homicide. Writing for SCOTUSblog.com, Lyle Denniston summarized the ruling. What sentencing judges must now do when a youth is convicted of murder that occurred before age 18 is to focus directly and only on that one individual in choosing a sentence. The judge must assess the specific age of that individual, examine that youth's childhood and life experience, weigh the degree of responsibility the youth was capable of exercising, and assess that youth's chances to become rehabilitated. Only if the judge then concludes that life without parole is a proportional penalty, given all of the factors that mitigate the youth's guilt, can he impose such a sentence. The court decision provided no specific guidelines nor any clearly defined list of factors that are to control that sentencing decision. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, who assesses the ruling and where it places the United States in comparison with how other nations treat young offenders convicted of serious crimes.
This is a very significant decision. First, because it's a continuing recognition by the court that juveniles are different from adults, in line with the court's decision in 2005, finding the death penalty unconstitutional for juveniles, then the 2010 decision in life without parole, banning it for non-homicide cases, and now the current cases, which may apply to as many as 2,000 of the 2,500 juveniles currently serving these terms. So it's been a fairly momentous shift in a relatively short period of time now. One of the main factors that's been leading to this reevaluation of juvenile sentencing has been new research on brain development over the last decade or so. And essentially what that has documented is that, in fact, juvenile brains are less developed. It's not until the earlier mid-20s that the adult brain is fully formed. What this means is that juveniles, you know, exhibit less maturity, they exhibit greater impulsiveness, less ability to foresee the consequences of their actions. What this means in a sentencing context is that, yes, they're responsible for their actions, but if we look at maturity, culpability issues, there are very distinct differences between a 15-year-old's ability to foresee the consequences of actions and a 30-year-old to do the same.
When you say this Supreme Court decision could affect as many as 2,000 of the 2,500 people serving life sentences without parole for crimes committed as juveniles, who are those prisoners in each of those categories?
The Supreme Court decision did not ban juvenile life without parole, but what the court did say is that the penalty cannot be imposed in a mandatory way. Right now in many states, if a juvenile is tried in adult court and convicted of homicide, the judge has no option in sentencing, has to impose mandatory life without parole. And so what the court said is that because they're juveniles, judges need to have discretion in considering what penalty to impose. They can look at the case and impose life without parole, but they have to have other options available to them as well. And so the initial estimates are that there may be as many as 2,000 of the 2,500 juveniles currently serving life without parole who were sentenced under these mandatory provisions that have now been found to be unconstitutional.
Mark Maurer, it's amazing, you know, to think that just a few years ago, this country was executing people whose crimes were committed when they were juveniles. Are there any other cases making their way to the Supreme Court that might further differentiate juvenile offenders from adults?
Well, I find this current decision very encouraging. It's important to put it in context also. The 2,500 juveniles serving life without parole in the United States is unimaginable by world standards. Research in recent years has not identified a single case anywhere else in the world where a juvenile has been sentenced to life without parole. So there's clearly still much ground that needs to be covered. In the coming years, there may be additional cases being brought. You know, one area of attention are the so-called felony murder cases. These are the ones where there may be two people involved in a robbery of a drugstore. One goes into the drugstore with a gun. The other is the getaway driver. Something goes bad. The gun goes off. The drugstore owner is killed. And the getaway driver is charged as if he had also committed the murder, even though he was the getaway driver. So obviously he's still culpable, but should he be responsible for the murder and be sentenced to juvenile life without parole? And there are significant numbers of cases like this currently serving these penalties. So there is some litigation going on around these issues as well. Whether they will reach the court in the near future, we don't know. But there are other avenues to address this question as well. The decision by the court is in keeping with some other trends in the world of policy and education on these issues. You know, in criminal justice, broadly speaking, I think there's a reexamination now of the excessive punishments of the 80s and 90s that were imposed, and we're beginning to see a turning around of some of these policies at the state level, reconsidering the war on drugs, mandatory sentencing, and also questions of life without parole. So I think we're cautiously optimistic that these trends will continue over the next decade and reconsider the wisdom and the justice of such policy.
That was Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project. For more information on the Supreme Court's ruling on juvenile crime, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Arizona's harsh immigration law, known as SB 1070, which was passed by the state's GOP-controlled legislature in the spring of 2010, provoked widespread anger, protests, and calls for an economic boycott. The law made it a crime for an immigrant not to carry documentation of their legal status in the U.S., allowed state police to arrest people without a warrant if they had probable cause to believe their actions would make them deportable under federal law, and made it illegal for an individual to apply for employment without federal work authorization. A fourth provision empowered Arizona State Police to investigate the immigration status of a person stopped, detained, or arrested if the officer had a reasonable suspicion that the individual was in the country illegally. On July 6, 2010, the U.S. Department of Justice filed a lawsuit against the state of Arizona seeking to overturn the law that they declared interfered with the power of the federal government to set and enforce immigration regulations. On June 25th, the Supreme Court struck down three key provisions of the law, but upheld the most controversial part that requires law enforcement to check the legal status of individuals suspected of being in the country illegally, the so-called papers please provision. The justices left the door open to future challenges on the basis of racial profiling. Your reporter spoke with Bill Chandler, executive director of the Mississippi Immigrants' Rights Alliance that works on expanding rights and opportunities of vulnerable immigrants. Here he provides analysis of the recent Supreme Court ruling on Arizona's SB 1070 immigration law and ongoing efforts to pass sensible federal immigration reform legislation.
Well, this Supreme Court decision was the result of a lawsuit that was filed that found its way relatively quickly through the Ninth Circuit. And there actually are other suits that are pending, both in the Ninth Circuit and in the Eleventh Circuit, from which is Alabama, throughout most of the Southeast. This decision, I think, opened the door for really more challenges. I think it gives, you know, a boost to the other suits. But most importantly, you know, the three sections that were removed by the Supreme Court, I think, you know, it will be very helpful for people not only in Arizona but here. But the major part of the challenge was the characterized as the papers please, which basically gives law enforcement officers, when they stop somebody allegedly for doing something other than being an immigrant, to inquire the immigration status. And we already have a lot of that going on, not only, of course, in Arizona and Alabama and Georgia and South Carolina, where, you know, similar laws have been enacted, but even here in Mississippi, where we do not have laws mandating that that happens. Some jurisdictions do it and some don't. I think that when there is an instance where somebody is being profiled and they challenge that decision, it will probably move in a better direction than the decision that was rendered by the court on that section.
Bill, what generally is your view of public opinion here in terms of the Arizona law? You know, there have been many polls, some contradicting one another, but it seems that there are a lot of states where, you know, emulating the paper please provision, which I guess is the most visible part of that legislation that was not struck down, is quite popular around the country.
Well, you might think back 50 years ago, the civil rights movement and the demands that it put forward were not popular, not only in the South, but, you know, across the United States. And it took a movement of people that was organized various fronts to begin to change that mentality so that the Civil Rights Act was passed and the Voting Rights Act was passed. And we're facing the same thing with immigration, where you have a majority, mostly white folks, that are alarmed that brown folks are in their community here and in other parts of the country that are driven by the same kinds of things that drove white people 50 years ago. And then, of course, you know, conditions and the violence that spurred the great migration. We see a repeat of the same things, and it's up to us to try to push forward and overcome that to stop the kinds of bills that have been introduced all over the country and passed in South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, and Arizona, of course, and other states.
Bill Chandler, with so much political conflict and actual paralysis in Washington over immigration reform, are you optimistic that this country can get to a place in the near term where Congress can pass some sensible immigration reform legislation?
Well, one, I think we have to get away from what they call comprehensive immigration reform. And what that bill does, you know, it really doesn't address the needs of the immigrants that are here without documentation in the way that it should. It focused on enforcement, getting more people in the Border Patrol, more people in ICE, more walls. It does not address the concerns of workers. It expands the so-called guest worker programs, which really entrap workers in a system that they are stuck with. And let's look at employer sanctions passed in 1986. And you can probably count on your fingers and your toes the number of employers that actually have been sanctioned for hiring undocumented people. But you're looking at hundreds of thousands of workers that have been arrested simply because they're working, trying to earn income for their families, and then deported because of the enactment of the law in 1986 that created employer sanctions. And that's a feature of the comprehensive immigration reform that we're very concerned with as well. We would like to level the playing field so that all workers have the same rights and can join together in unions if they desire and be able to take on issues in the workplace that bother them without the threat of deportation. But it's going to take a real movement of the people that are concerned about this, that understand, you know, what really needs to be done if we're going to be welcoming the immigrants in our community.
That was Bill Chandler, Executive Director of the Mississippi Immigrants Rights Alliance. Find links to more news and analysis on issues confronting undocumented immigrants by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.